Tom Woods Show, episode 1704.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, for another libertarian podcast to help fill your daily routine, check out my friends at Good Morning Liberty. They're talking every single day about libertarian solutions to the problems that ail us. Check them out at BernieLies.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I got something today for you from the distant past. Before we get to that, I want to remind you of what you can do in the terrible situation that can at times befall you when you have exhausted the Tom Woods Show episode archive. There's nothing else for you to listen to. You've listened to the whole darn thing. What are you going to do now? How are you going to get libertarian content? And I want to remind you of my friends over at Good Morning Liberty. They're putting out a regular podcast on current events through a libertarian lens that is very, very good. It was started by two libertarian business owners in Nashville, Tennessee. As musicians in Nashville, Charlie and Nate hit multiple Billboard charts, each with their own bands, touring through 14 countries, 48 states. They've had number one songs, MTV VMA appearances, even acted in commercials, all while never being signed to a record label. In 2017, they formed a healthcare IT company, which helps to give healthcare companies the ability to navigate regulation, become as efficient as possible. So Good Morning Liberty is a podcast focused on highlighting free market solutions for today's political and economic problems. So they believe that if you own yourself, then libertarianism is the most moral political ideology there is, and they aim to prove it. So every day, new episode of Good Morning Liberty. So check it out on your favorite podcast app or on their website, BernieLies.com. So go check that out. And now for today, I had something come up at the last minute. So what I'm going to do is share something that I know for a fact you've never heard before. It's impossible for you to have heard this because of just how obscure the origin of it is. What you're about to hear was recorded in February 2009, right? This was the Young Americans for Liberty Arlington High School chapter in New York that launched a podcast at that time. And the very first episode they did was with me. And this was very, very shortly after my book Meltdown had come out on the financial crisis of 2008. But we didn't talk about just that. We talked about a wide variety of topics relating to economics. And we even at the end get to the World War II didn't get us out of the Great Depression thing. There's a lot of good material in here. But yeah, it's old. But it's, you know, these are ideas we need to get out there. And we haven't solved the problem of people believing bad ideas in the intervening 11 years. So it's evergreen. So here we go. I hope you enjoy it. And then afterward, do not turn off your device because I want to tell you about something a couple of my listeners did, including your good friend, Anthony Samaroff. You know our friend, Anthony Samaroff, been on this show several times from the Scottish Liberty podcast and the Libertarian Party of Scotland, one of the greatest guys in the whole universe, has something going on that I think you guys should know about. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, enjoy.
Well, welcome to First Ever Young Americans for Liberty podcast. My name is Aaron Ricks. I'm the president of the Arlington High School chapter of the Young Americans for Liberty. Along with me in here is Kyle Peabody and Michael Lee, senior members of the club. Delighted to have as our first guest, Mr. Tom Woods. Mr. Woods is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Now, Mr. Woods, your new book just released a week or two ago, Meltdown, a free market look at why the stock market collapsed, the economy tanked, and the government bailouts to make things worse. Now, personally, I really dove into the theory of Gaussian economics a little more than a year ago, around the time I started paying attention to the Ron Paul campaign and listening to Peter Schiff interviews, which, as everyone says, are very amusing. Now, as a high school student, I read your book, or at least most of it. I didn't have time, the time I would have liked to take go through it. Be the first to admit that advanced economics theory isn't something easy to grasp. Now, the first book I read was Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. Easy to understand, okay. The logic was compelling. Now, it seems to me your book kind of reaches to the same audience, those without experience in economic theory. So, but at the same time, it kind of tells the world this is what happened, this is what's going on, and this is how we got here. So, Mr. Woods, we're going to try to talk about the economy, you know, make a miracle without pushing equities down 5%. So what did you hope to accomplish with this new book?
Well, more or less, as you said, I wanted the average American to be able to read this thing, understand what's going on, how we got here, and what we can do to get out. And so far, I've been getting emails and website comments that people submit to me through my site, just telling me that this is exactly what's happened, that now they understand it better than ever. They weren't quite sure what was going on. But in particular, I mean, you'll notice the book is coming out, you know, very, very quickly. I mean, it's if you read it, definitely. You find that it talks about events that are going through December 2008. So for the publisher to be able to get it out that quickly was just a wonderful thing. And so I raced to write and finish this thing because I did not want the conventional wisdom, which is that, oh, the free market has failed, and so now we need all the geniuses in Washington who are our wise rulers to take over the economy for us. I just did not want that to go unchallenged. And I figured I'd be able to beat most books on the subject. There'll be a lot of books coming out this year, and they're going to be disastrous, basically. And in fact, my book Meltdown has a foreword by Ron Paul in which he says exactly that I'm pretty sure there's going to be an avalanche of books and they're all going to be a disaster. So I figured I would, you know, sort of do one for the good guys, get it out there, make it marginally harder for the media to pretend that the free market interpretation of all this doesn't exist. And the sales of it so far, I mean, it's too early to get any hard figures, but I mean, it's selling like crazy. So I'm hopeful that it will gum up the works a little bit, you know, as they try to claim that this is a big failure of the free market. I wanted the book to counter them, but also to help people who support the free market to make the arguments, to learn what the arguments are so that they can defend themselves.
Yeah, definitely. The argument is here. The media can't pretend that we don't have an argument, and it's right here in your book, and there's been tons of articles available at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Now, a few questions that I've kind of gathered from a few of my friends. I live in New York. It's definitely left of center. So one of the questions they had for you was, as I was reading your book, is greed. Greed as a cause for a financial collapse. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I feel like an explanation that relies on greed really begs the question. I mean, why did people suddenly become greedy in the 21st century? I mean, this seems to be pretty unsatisfying. I mean, the question would have to be, I guess I'd put it this way. Everybody's, you know, part of human nature is that people can be greedy. That's just unavoidable. So the question is, what institutional framework can cope the best with this undeniable aspect of human nature? And it seems to me the free market copes the best with it, because if you want to improve your material well-being, how do you do that in a genuine free market? In a genuine free market, you do that by doing something that pleases your fellow man. That's how you get his money, legally. That's how you get his money. So that's the institutional framework that in effect helps us best cope with greed. Whereas a framework that is status, that's dominated by government, is not so helpful. Because the greedy people just wind up in government, and they use government to line their own pockets and loot the rest of the population. Whereas, you know, a businessman has to get the voluntary consent of his customer. Nobody in government needs the voluntary consent of anybody. They're the government. They have a monopoly on violence. So when I look at this crisis and people try to tell me it's caused by greed, well, look, of course there are some greedy people. No question about that. But what kind of environment is it in which greed can lead to an outcome like this? And what I want to argue is that explanations that simply refer to greed leave out the institutional factors that allow greed to flourish. And those institutional factors would be, for instance, the unmentionable Federal Reserve System, which pumps, in this case, literally insane amounts of money into the system, thereby lowering interest rates below where the free market would have set them. And this, you know, makes banks respond. I mean, banks respond when their bank is full of fresh reserves created by the Fed. Well, they're going to lend it out, and that's not greed per se. That's just the natural course of events for a bank. They've got reserves. They burn a hole in their pockets. They don't know what to do with it. And so when the banks see that they've got all these reserves to lend, well, they've got to make that money available on easier terms than before. Because at any given time, the banks are all lent up to the limit they're allowed to. So if they're going to find new people to lend to, these new people are either going to have to get lower interest rates to entice them to borrow all this new money, or these people are going to be people who have lower credit ratings and are not as credit worthy. Something needs to be done in order to move all this new money out the door. And sure, the banks make a pile of dough on this and they're doing great, but as I say, it's not greed per se. It's, well, who put all these reserves there in the first place? It's the Fed. I mean, we have to look at the Federal Reserve System as a key factor in this. And it usually, what typically happens is the Fed, which most Americans don't know the first thing about, and they hear Federal Reserve and they just clam up. They figure, this is too complicated. I can never understand it. I wrote Meltdown so the average person could understand the Fed. And it's essential that we understand it because the Fed will screw up the economy. And then because the Fed is never allowed to be mentioned in the media, hardly ever, never mentioned in our political system, the consequences of what the Fed does are then blamed stupidly on the free market. Ah, it just goes to show the free market is unstable. The free market is surprisingly stable, but it becomes unstable when you intervene in it. And that's what the Fed does. The Fed's very existence is a violation of the free market.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It just, to me, it sounded like almost a misnomer. Like there's no tangible evidence behind the whole argument that greed causes a financial collapse. Now, one of the things I commend you for is you mentioned panics and crashes even before the Federal Reserve's coming to existence. These crashes are still a function of the same exact principles that we see in later booms and busts when the Federal Reserve was created. Can you elaborate a bit on these previous panics and crashes?
Yeah, sure. And let me try and do like a 90-second overview of what the Austrian School of Economics teaches about this. Because what the Austrian School teaches and what F.A. Hayek won the Nobel Prize for was arguing that, you know, basically there are two ways interest rates can come down. One is that you and I save more. And when we save more, then, you know, the banks have more to lend. So interest rates come down. But another way that interest rates can come down is that the central bank forces them down through its interventions. And there are, according to Hayek, there are different consequences for the economy of each of these two cases. When you and I save more, and that's what's bringing the interest rates down, that's fine. That's good. The economy can sustain that because when the interest rates are lower, that's when businesses, particularly engaged in long-term projects, are more likely to invest because, well, they don't have to pay as high interest. And that's good because when you and I save more, that means we're not consuming as much now. We're going to consume more in the future. And so businesses are borrowing this money to go out and create projects that are aimed at future production of goods. So that's good. We're going to consume in the future, and they're producing for the future. It's wonderful. But if interest rates come down just because the central bank forces them down, well, now we've got a time mismatch because now investors once again will invest in long-term projects aimed at the future, but we haven't necessarily indicated a desire to consume less in the present to fund these investments. In fact, we may even be consuming just as much or more than before. So meanwhile, you've got investors investing for the future, but consumers are demanding more of existing goods right now. You've got investors engaged in product development at a time when Americans want more of existing products right now. So there's a time mismatch. And secondly, when you and I save more, the fact that we're not consuming as much releases resources that investors can use to finish their investment projects. But when the interest rate comes down just because it's been artificially forced down, well, that doesn't magically produce all the physical goods necessary to finish all the investment projects that businessmen will start. So they're going to find that they cannot afford to finish a lot of these projects. So in other words, when you interfere with interest rates and you don't let the free market set them, you disrupt this delicate coordinating mechanism that coordinates production across time. Now this, as I say, this won the Nobel Prize, this theory. But what you will often hear people say is, okay, even if I grant you that, even if I grant you that this is why we have these booms and busts, it doesn't account for all the booms and busts and panics and recessions and depressions we had before we had a Federal Reserve System. How can you blame that on the Fed? And the answer is, well, okay, on that trivial ground, you're right. I can't blame that strictly on the Fed. But it is nevertheless the same factor, the same events, the same interference in with money and interest rates that we see in all other panics. Because if you look in the 19th century, you don't have a Fed, but you do in many cases have a government-established national bank with government-granted monopoly privileges, which you had leading into the panic of 1819, leading into the panic of 1837. And they create more money than the free market would have created, and they push interest rates down lower. And I quote people, contemporaries from the 19th century, looking at these panics, and what they're describing, the phenomena they're describing, are exactly what Hayek describes about the business cycle, that we see an excess of investment in certain unsustainable lines, and then we've seen this bust, and everything's come crashing down. It's exactly the same thing. And you look at all the other panics, it's either, again, some national bank that's authorized by the federal government, or it's the banking system in general simply creating money out of thin air, which in effect puts the economy on a kind of sugar high that can't last. It doesn't have a real foundation. It's phony. And so all these panics are all explainable on the same grounds.
Well, yeah, definitely. I think it's really hard for people to realize that governments, by definition, don't produce anything. That, you know, the only way they get things done is by taking from productive members of society.
Yeah, that's exactly, in fact, can I elaborate on that? Because in the same way that governments don't have any resource and don't create anything, neither do central banks. So the mere fact that the Fed or some central bank lowers interest rates, that doesn't magically create resources. All it does, if I lend out money that I've just created out of thin air, that doesn't create any additional goods. So it means whoever borrows that money, there are no additional goods for them to command with the money. All they do is there's an unchanged amount of goods in the economy, but now more dollars. So now whoever gets this new money gets to draw more of the economy's existing resource pool to himself, but we haven't increased wealth overall. We've just redistributed it around.
Well, definitely. So, I mean, there's no way to, you know, even disagree with that. I mean, central banks have no real power whatsoever. They just take from, they print money, and, you know, we make up for it through inflation. And now, well, I'm going to turn it over to Kyle to ask some questions that we've gathered from some of the audience out there. So Kyle, want to take it away?
Yeah, sure. Mr. Woods, do you have any suggestions for students who would like to spread the message of this book?
Well, buy it and give it away. But no, but other than that, I mean, basically just, you know, don't, when you're sitting there listening to people talk about the economy, most of them don't know anything they're talking about, don't just let it go uncommented on. You know, when the, you know, just because you're afraid to have a friendly debate or something, you know, at least make them aware that there is an alternative point of view. And again, it's a point of view that won the Nobel Prize. So it's not like it's some crazy point of view that just you hold, or, you know, you're some kind of an eccentric person for holding. It's a completely honorable point of view. And I would point out, who are the people who actually predicted there would be a problem? I quote in my in Meltdown, I quote James Galbraith, who said in the New York Times that of the 15,000 professional economists in the country, roughly, he estimates maybe a dozen saw this coming. Now, that's just, you know, maybe a dozen of the people he knows, but, I mean, there were hundreds of Austrian economists who saw it coming. And so overwhelmingly, the people who predicted that there would be a collapse are the same people who have been critical of the Fed, who have been critical of fiat money, that is money that can't be converted into anything, it's based on nothing, can just be printed up indefinitely by a printing press. It's all the people who basically hold our points of view are almost the only ones who weren't completely clueless. Now, I mean, that is a type of argument that I think gets people's attention, that the only ones who actually saw this coming overwhelmingly are the ones who have this particular theory as to what caused it. Whereas the people who now are instructing us and who now are trying to run our economy, those people, well, almost none of them saw it coming. So, I mean, how are they supposed to fix a problem they weren't even aware of?
Exactly. Another question, Austin Brenneman, a member of the Young Americans for Liberty movement, wants to know, if you had to make a recommendation right now, would you encourage Dr. Paul to run again in 2012?
Well, I asked him about this back in the summertime, and you know, at that time he was saying, oh, you know, he seemed down on the idea. But when I look back on it and I listen to think about what he actually said, didn't actually rule it out. He just simply said, I can't even think that far ahead. Now, you know, he's not a politician, we know, in the traditional sense. But at the same time, I wonder, was that a politician answer? I don't know. I don't know if that means maybe when time passes, I'll give it some thought. I mean, you know, I would like to see it. I would like to see it just because I suspect that he's going to be so vindicated by the time 2012 runs around that people are going to have to listen to him. And plus, when you consider by the time, you know, let's say February, March of 08 rolled around, I feel like we were just finally hitting our stride at that point. Like, we were really just getting going. We suddenly had a lot of people now who had been turned on to these ideas, were spreading. So if we'd had just a little more time, and, you know, maybe there'd been some important personnel changes, let's say, I think the potential was really very great. And now we've got 4 years to keep building the base, and the Campaign for Liberty is holding events all over the country. I think he would have a very, very substantial base of support. So, but maybe I'm just saying this because I'm selfish and I just had so much fun during the Ron Paul campaign that I hated to see it end. You know, I don't know if you were like me, but like, what do I do on my computer all day when there are no more YouTubes to watch and news things to keep up with? You know, so I would just, I think, but also, you know, even if he didn't win, and I don't want to start it off by, I don't want people to think that I think he can't win. I don't think that he can't win. I do think that he can win. But even if he didn't, I mean, what we saw in 2008 was that he has changed the landscape forever. The Federal Reserve System is now on the table. People talk about it. Peter Schiff has an in now, partly because of Ron Paul, I think. A lot of us are getting hearings that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I go on all kinds of radio shows, and I mean big-time radio shows, where the host knows all about the Fed. That's because of Ron Paul. And so he, and but beyond that, we got all people like you guys, young people coming out of nowhere, huge, huge numbers of them who are hearing about this stuff for the first time. That's because of him. This did not go to waste. This is one of the great opportunities we ever had. So to have a chance to do that again, and the prospect that I would say, no, we shouldn't do it, you got to be crazy. Of course we should.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, yeah.
And another question from Mark Suriano is, what's your opinion on a gold-based currency versus a fiat-based currency?
Well, I mean, of course, I think a gold-based one is infinitely preferable because, and again, in Meltdown, I quote Henry Hazlitt, who, of course, wrote Economics in One Lesson, but Hazlitt said, you know, there are a lot of people who have these tiny little technical criticisms of the gold standard. He said, but the fact is a gold money is a money that cannot be arbitrarily interfered with or destroyed by politicians. And he said, now, this single merit makes all technical criticisms of the gold standard utterly trivial by comparison. And so, but my view though is not so much that we should go back to a gold-backed money because or a gold standard per se. I mean, if people want that, that's fine with me. But a gold standard that would require the government to maintain it and to maintain the ratio of dollars to gold, I think is unrealistic because, you know, look at the politicians who we have in Washington. Which one of them, other than Ron Paul, would you trust to do that? I mean, what's to stop them from just going off the gold standard again or fiddling around with it or whatever? I mean, why would we trust them with it? Instead, I think we need to think in more radical ways. We need to think about what Hayek said toward the end of his career. In the late 70s, he gave a speech actually in New Orleans. And the speech is reprinted in the Journal of Libertarian Studies in the late 70s. You can find it on Mises.org. And I quoted in Meltdown. Hayek said that, you know, we cannot ever again expect to get a good money from government. There's no reason for them to supply it to us. And he says, secondly, it is a mere historical accident that governments have come to supply money. It's not like the inherent nature of things requires government to do this. He says governments supply us money not because of the civics textbook reasons you learn in school that the government aims to bring about the common good, and so it gives us a good money that we can come on, you know, just don't insult me with that. The reason they want to control the money supply is so they can create money out of thin air and reward their friends with it. I mean, that's what it's for. That's why the government monopolizes money. And given this is the case, what we instead should do is look to the free market, and that the free market supplies every good we need, and it supplies it the most efficiently. So why don't we look for free market alternatives? And the way we start doing that is really to follow Ron Paul's advice, which is get rid of all sales and capital gains taxes on precious metals, which would serve to obstruct their use as money. And secondly, repeal legal tender laws. Those are monopolistic interferences in the free market. Get rid of that, because legal tender laws mean basically that government courts will not enforce contracts that require payment in gold, because the person is, because of legal tender, is allowed to pay you in the depreciating dollar. So that makes it very hard for alternatives to pop up, because all alternatives are at artificial disadvantages. Let's have a level playing field and let's see how the market deals with it. And we're already seeing various companies starting up that will in fact make gold transactions for you, and you can have debit cards, whatever. I mean, this transition could be affected very swiftly by the free market.
Yeah, we're already seeing some independent currencies that are backed by gold starting to become popular. I've read about a few articles online of people starting up their own currencies. Moving on to a question from Caitlin Zinsley. She's a leader of one of the more liberal clubs at our school. She asked, how are markets supposed to account for the gap between the rich and the poor?
Okay, now I don't know what she means by account for. I mean, does she mean deal with, do you think?
Yes, I mean, like,
part of my answer is look at those countries in the world where the gap between the rich and the poor is the widest. And those are the countries that are the farthest away from the free market. That's always the case. I mean, you know, in the Soviet Union, the apparatchiks did very, very well. The average person suffered tremendously. Look at Africa. I mean, the only places in Africa where you've got anything approaching a free market would be Botswana. And by the way, Botswana, here's a big surprise. Botswana is one of the richest countries in Africa. Big surprise there, right? South Africa, well, you know, it's kind of a mess right now. But I mean, you can find isolated pockets of the free market. But otherwise, it's a bunch of extremely, you know, it's just awful dictators who have free market. Come on. I mean, they just run the countries the way they want. And they've got magnificent palaces while everybody else is eating dirt. In fact, if you look at the countries of the world and you just want to see in what countries are the poorest people doing the best, which countries, so to speak, have the richest poor, they are always the free market countries. Would you rather be poor in Bangladesh or would you rather be poor in Hong Kong? And this holds true consistently as a rule. So it seems to me that if we genuinely care about the poor, I mean, look, if somebody has three yachts in a free market society, that doesn't hurt me any. He's not stealing them from me. I didn't have them to start with, I assure you. That's, you know, if we can just set envy aside for 5 seconds and actually demonstrate a real concern for people who are poor, we would not consign them to systems that have made the poor worse off. Even if you look at so-called third way European welfare states like Sweden, American blacks on average are richer than the average Swede. And American blacks are not doing as well as some other groups in America, and yet they are doing better than Swedes in general. So if you really care about the well-being of the poor, you would want to adopt the system that provides for their material well-being better than any other system. Whereas if all you care about is seeming to care about the poor, then quash the market economy, destroy wealth creation, and make everybody, you know, at the same poor level, and then you'll be successful, then everybody will be poor. But I find it hard to believe that people genuinely care about the welfare of the poor and then can't be bothered to look up the actual facts.
Yeah, I agree with that. Another question is from Matt from Syracuse. He says, on a virtual level, the Austrian business cycle theory makes complete sense, but when you consider it with respect to the recent crisis, it's a bit harder to put the pieces together. Specifically, the Austrian business cycle holds the capital goods industries that are most affected by both the artificial boom and the subsequent bust, yet it was housing that was the prime player in today's crisis, not exactly a capital good. How does the Austrian business cycle deal with this?
Well, part of the answer is that, I mean, housing is at the very least an extremely durable consumer good. But secondly, it's not just housing that's going to ultimately bust. It's also going to be commercial real estate. That is the buildings in which businesses operate. Or a lot of times businesses will have built an addition, or they will have built a second building for a second branch of the business. And that is arguably, and in fact, Gerald Celeni makes this point, that's actually going to be a worse bust than residential households are going to be. So that in effect reinforces Austrian business cycle theory, that the more capital intensive will get hit harder. Well, the more capital intensive type of building projects, the commercial real estate market is in fact going to wind up being hit harder than just regular residential real estate. So there's that. But also, I mean, remember that how are people financing this real estate? How are people going out and buying a house? Well, they're buying it with, you know, basically with this 30-year mortgage thing, which is in itself partly a government intervention. I mean, most people in the 30s didn't own their own homes. Nobody would lend to you for 30 years because you can never tell what inflation is going to do and so on and so forth. So this sort of long-term type of an expenditure is very interest rate sensitive, unlike consumer goods like toothbrushes or hats or potato chips. A house is a large, durable purchase that is paid for over a long span of time. So I think that does, in fact, still make it qualify as something that would be artificially encouraged by artificially low interest rates. Because, of course, if the interest rate is 21%, imagine what a 30-year mortgage would amount to. Whereas if the interest rate comes down to 4 or 5%, you're much more likely to take out that 30-year that 30-year mortgage. So the point is that it's long-term things that tend to be the most interest rate sensitive where you will see the biggest busts. And as I say, commercial real estate is going to be hit harder. But given that housing is a long-term project of paying it off, and it's very, very interest rate sensitive, well, naturally that would act, that the Austrian theory would can be conformed to this idea that you've had a boom in residential housing.
Well, definitely. Okay. One of the best things I've ever heard about the Austrian theory was that, you know, it encourages production and savings besides not this kind of artificial consumption and, you know, buy as much as you can because the businesses are dying. I mean, how much more can we buy? We've been buying for so long. I mean, how much more do they want us to do? How much more debt did they want the American people to have?
Right. And I've got an article coming out on the Campaign for Liberty site sometime this week sort of explaining this, because I know that there is a superficial plausibility to the idea that people should spend because, you know, how can businesses stay in business if people don't spend? And there are a lot of different replies to that. But one that's relevant to today is, as you say, it's not spending per se that we need, because if that were the case, everybody should get into debt up to his eyeballs, as a lot of people already are, and then go out and spend. But then, you know, well, then what will we do 3 weeks from now when we're so in debt that we can't spend anymore? I mean, obviously that can't be the solution in and of itself. But beyond that, the fact is that because of the housing boom, people spent more than they should have. They thought they were richer than they really were because everybody thinks he's sitting on a $500,000 house. Now they realize they're not. And now they realize they've engaged in more consumption spending than they should have, or they borrowed against the equity in their homes to finance consumption spending. And they wouldn't have done that if they had known the real value of their homes. So what we're starting to see now is that in the boom, it was not just housing that was affected by the boom. The boom distorts all lines of production, or a lot of lines of production, that wouldn't have occurred without the boom. And so, for instance, we're now learning that Starbucks, or at least its one store every 10 feet business model, was a bubble activity. I mean, they are closing stores like you wouldn't believe because, yeah, when people feel like, hey, I got an infinitely appreciating asset in the form of my house, well, sure, a $5 cup of coffee, yeah, sky's the limit. Or a $6 ice cream cone and Cold Stone Creamery, great, you know, fine, let's do it. But we're now seeing that those are bubble activities. They're going south fast. And so it's not so much that we need spending per se. We don't need people to go out and spend $5 cups of coffee. What we need is for the economy to realize, wait a minute, $5 cups of coffee are not what we need to be producing. We need capital to go out of that and to produce $1 cups of coffee. So what we need is a restructuring of the economy so that it produces things people can sustainably spend their money on. We don't want to freeze this economy just the way it is and tell people to keep spending. We're producing things that people can't afford. We're producing more plasma TVs maybe than we should be. I don't exactly know what we're producing too much of. That's why we have a price system. But we need the economy to sort out what is sustainable in a post-bubble economy and what should be allowed to go out of business, and then we will restore an equilibrium where people will spend and will be producing things that people want. But just throwing money at the existing economy is just going to prop up zombies. That's the last thing we want.
On that note, the Obama administration so far has spent over $1 trillion, and God knows how much the Geithner Bank program could cost. But if they continue on this path, what do you see happening in the next 4 years?
Well, I mean, if they continue on this path, I just can't see how the economy could recover. I mean, markets are incredibly resilient. And I mean, the market was trying to recover in the early years of the New Deal. I mean, there are some signs of that. So it can fight against government intervention. But given that we've got no savings, you know, we're very much hollowed out as an economy, it's hard to see where the resources for the recovery could come from, given that our pool of savings has been stretched thin or is almost non-existent, and then what little we have left the government wants to raid so it can spend on arbitrary projects to reward political favorites. So I don't see where the recovery could come from. So we could, you know, best case scenario, we degenerate to a West European welfare state model where they have extremely sluggish growth, if any growth at all. They have high unemployment and they pretend not to know why this is happening to them. Or there is the possibility of, you know, the worst case scenario is a complete collapse of the whole system, a complete collapse of the dollar with all this pressure being put on it. I think it's very hard to know which of those outcomes will happen, but they are both, neither one of them is completely implausible.
Okay, now we have a caller, Matt, from Syracuse University. He's going to ask you a question. Matt, you're live.
Hey, Tom, how's it going? Big fan. This is more of a prod than a question. So conservative pundits and politicians who are repugnant on pretty much everything when Republicans in office, but sometimes all right on economics when a Democrat's in office, they usually will stick with us in saying that the New Deal didn't cure the Great Depression. Some will even say that it did make it worse. But they'll usually follow lockstep behind your Paul Krugman of the world in saying that the public works project that was World War II actually cured us of the Depression. Can you just speak to kind of curing people of this kind of fallacy, this notion that World War II broke the Depression? I know you're going to reference Higgs and everything. And so just go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, sure. Well, there is actually discussion of this in Meltdown, because I feel like if you concede this point and say that, well, you know, okay, we'll grant you that the New Deal didn't get us out of the Depression, but World War II did, then you're giving away the whole argument to the stimulus people. Because then they'll come back today and say, well, World War II just proves that if the stimulus is big enough, it'll lift us out of it. I don't want to concede that point to them. And there's no need to. Because when you actually look at the situation, first of all, there should be some alarm bells going off when you hear that the war was good for us. I mean, when you have a war and you've got 12 million people drafted into the armed forces, 12 million of your prime workers, and they're drafted into the armed forces, they're no longer available to produce goods and services, and 40% of the economy, 40% is either devoted to the armed forces, or it's devoted to civilian employees of the armed forces, or it's devoted to military spending. When you've got 40% of the economy producing goods, in other words, that the rest of the economy, the consumers, don't buy, how can that be good? I mean, should we take 40% of the labor force today and have them build pyramids, and would that make the other 60% rich? I mean, this is obviously a fallacy. So we've got 40% of the economy producing producing goods consumers can't buy, and who's financing this? The 60%. So the 60%, to add insult to injury, now find they have fewer goods to buy because all the resources are being diverted to military production, and then they have to spend their tax money to finance this situation. So right off the bat, you know, there's something fishy about it. Well, then you have the fact that, okay, employment, you know, unemployment goes down during the war. Well, you know, presumably I don't have to draw you a diagram of what happens to unemployment when you take 12 million people and ship them overseas. You know, unemployment goes down. Congratulations. I mean, by the same token, we could get rid of unemployment by just killing all the unemployed people. But I assume that's not how we want to do it. That's not how a healthy economy does it. And then secondly, we consider that, again, these are prime workers. These are men, you know, of good, you know, young age who are being sent off to fight. So these are your best skilled workers. While they're overseas fighting, who's taking up their jobs at home? Women with very little work experience, very young people with very little work experience, and older people. So when you look at the GDP data for the 1940s that tells you that we had a great boom in America during the war, you have to ask yourself, wait a minute, do these statistics make any sense? How could we have the biggest boom in the history of the United States at a time when the economy is suddenly finding itself under unprecedented resource constraints? The best workers have been shipped away and replaced by inexperienced people, and that gives us the single greatest boom in American history. How can that be? There's got to be something wrong with this. And so the rest of the answer, and I'll make this as quick as I can, the rest of the answer is that these GDP figures are totally misleading. They're just phony numbers. GDP is a screwy number to begin with under ideal circumstances. But basically what happened is that the economy was so controlled by the government during the war that so many of the prices were just dictated by the government. This is what we're going to pay for this good. Now you go and produce it for us for the war. And this has spillover effects and affects other prices in the economy. Prices are only meaningful if they arise voluntarily between the bids of buyers and sellers for products. But if the government were to arbitrarily say, from now on, the price of eggs is, we declare to be $10 per egg, and the government is going to order 1 million eggs. If we were to multiply $10 per egg by 1 million eggs, arrive at $10 million, and then add that to our national income, how have we said anything of value about the economy? What does that tell you about the economy? Nothing, because the price of $10 is totally arbitrary. So a GDP figure that amounts to adding a whole bunch of arbitrary figures up is one giant arbitrary figure. So this does not produce a recovery. It actually makes the private economy much worse during the 40s. People can't buy most of the goods they want to buy, and those few goods they can buy are severely rationed. That gives you a genuine picture of the economy. The restoration came after the war, in the fantastic year of 1946, when there's no more New Deal being promised, the federal government is going to behave itself from now on, and there's no more dislocation of war, and you have some of your good men back there working. That's when you have your recovery, but it is not brought about by World War II.
Tom, so one of the hosts mentioned earlier that they had a liberal friend at their school that kind of couldn't see through the free market view on this. I'm wondering if you can speak to how the current financial system, how the Federal Reserve, how the government is currently set up, how that kind of feeds into the warfare state. I feel like a good answer on that would be something that could appeal to more liberal people.
Yeah. Well, think of it this way. Is government going to be more able to wage destructive wars and, by and large, without the full enthusiastic consent of the population? Is it going to be more likely to be able to do that if it can just print up the money it needs to finance it out of thin air, or if it has to actually go to the population and get the money either through borrowing from the population or through taxes? I mean, the question answers itself. If you really, really honestly care about war, and it's not just posturing, and it's not just a way to skip school for the day, but if you really believe it, if you really believe that war is evil and that a lot of these wars that we've seen in recent years have been just unbelievable atrocities, well, then it's very hard to take you seriously if you're going to say, but, you know, the government needs to be able to create out of thin air, out of absolutely nothing, with nobody's consent, even if the population is dead set against it, they need to be able to create all the money out of thin air that they want. I mean, that was what made Vietnam possible. Because how did Lyndon Johnson finance that? I mean, very, very large proportion of it was through just creating the money out of nowhere. Likewise for the Iraq War. Taxes weren't raised, so where did the money come from? It was basically borrowing from foreigners and then creating the money, just printing the money up, and that's what made the war possible. So you can tell me all day long about you're all tears and pity for the Iraqi people and how terrible this is, but if you're going to sit here and either ignore or actually defend the government's power to fund these atrocities with money it has a monopoly on creating, you've just got to be kidding me. So, I mean, now you probably want to say this a little more nicely in a nicer tone than I just did. But I mean, as I say, if the war machine also runs a money machine, do you think there's going to be more war or less war? I mean, this is not brain surgery.
Well, thanks a lot. Just one more question, Mr. Woods. Do you have an idea for another book?
I've been writing an awful lot of books lately. And so for the immediate run, I don't, just because I worked just day and night on Meltdown, and it really took a lot out of me, to be honest with you. So, people have actually been writing to me say, hey, you know, you're writing books faster than I can read them. Well, then maybe for right now, I'm going to let people catch up a little bit while I get some recuperation.
I'm not going to lie. I was impressed with all the, with all those citations, and you sourced everything that you said. And there was five pages of sources in the back, and I love it. And I'm going to go through all of them as soon as I have the chance. But, Thank you very much, Mr. Woods. I guess we're going to conclude. Thanks for talking to us. It's been a very enjoyable experience. And we're grateful that you took time out of your busy schedule to talk with other liberty-minded people and to get the message out there. So to everyone listening, buy Meltdown. It's available on Amazon.com. It's a great book, and I highly recommend it. Thank you very much, Mr. Woods.
Thank you, guys. And check me out at TomWoods.com, where I've got a free chapter of the book available.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
All right, everybody. Before you go, here's what I want to tell you about that our friend Anthony Samaroff and a colleague of his have been working on together, and that is a website called SovereignCounties.org. The idea of it is it's a discussion forum that offers, you know, many of the advantages of, let's say, a site like Reddit, but with a more narrow focus and, let's say, less risk of cancellation, so to speak. So it encourages participants to discuss local issues, but the topics discussed there appeal to anybody with a secessionist bent, which is, you know, like you and me. So it doesn't matter whether you identify more with Murray Rothbard or Murray Bookchin, you're welcome there. And even if you only want to debunk their utopian delusions, as they put it, you're also welcome. And it also integrates and enhances video streaming services like YouTube and Vimeo while insulating content providers from political filters at each service. They can also host your video on their server. Your followers will discuss all your content through one interface, and their discussion forum is far superior to YouTube comments. Sovereign Counties also offers other unique features enabling members easily to engage with web content and related discussion topics. They support major desktop and mobile browsers, and their open source software uses only common standards, so it's easily portable to any Linux server. So check it out over at sovereigncounties.org. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1704 as well. And remember, you can get a nice shout-out like this and a lot of other really great free advantages by just using my link when you go to get your web hosting. So check out the details of all the goodies I have to offer you and how to get them over at tomwoods.com/publicity, and I'll see you all next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.